Welcome to the Pop Culture Cosmos.
And we're back with another episode of the Pop Culture Cosmos. It's Gerald Glassford coming right back at you here from Pop Culture Cosmos, the Lakers Fast Break, Game Source, Inside Sports Fantasy Football. Go ahead and make sure you give some love to each and every one of these outlets. Please go ahead and like, share, subscribe today to get the latest notifications on when we go live on the air with the latest Pop Culture Cosmos, Inside Sports Fantasy Football, Lakers Fast Break. We even give you some notice when we go on for the State of Pro Wrestling, Inside Sports Fantasy Football, or special interviews that only we do right here at the Pop Culture Cosmos. But it wouldn't be a Pop Culture Cosmos without my good friend. He is the mastermind behind HappyHoarderCollectibles.com. And Happy Hoarder Collectibles, I'm going to assume in the not too distant future, after he watched Dune Part 2, that he'll be getting his hands on some collectibles from Dune Part 2. It is a good man indeed. Please go ahead and support him today at HappyHoarderCollectibles.com. It is Josh Peterson. What's up, man? Sounds like you had a very interesting conversation in order for me, because I love it when you say, I have some things to talk about when it concerns Dune Part 2.
Yes. Yeah. We made it to the theaters today to check out this juggernaut of a film. And yeah, I do have some thoughts. As for the Dune toys, I actually had some in stock and they came and went, man. The McFarlane made a pretty cool line of Dune Part 2 toys, and they were, you always have, anytime you have like a movie wave come out, you always have a couple characters that people don't want. Like nobody wanted the Baron Harkonnen toy because it didn't come in like a thin box. He was massive, you know, just like the character. So the box was like three times as big as the normal action figure box. So I had a hard time pushing that, and it would not hang on the pegs for the life of it. So that was annoying. But yeah, I don't know. They're pretty cool toys.
I will tell you before we get on with the show that I said that we were doing a driving lesson / community yard sale hunting in my area here, as far as driving before the show today. And the first place we stopped off, he wasn't selling anything more than just a couple tables worth of video games, video game systems. And I was, oh my gosh, yeah, it's good stuff. Maybe I'll go ahead. And of course, it's all, there's like three or four guys there. They're all around my age. They're all looking through it. They all know what they're doing. And I see here the guy that's actually using this and doing this and conducting this yard sale. He's thanking somebody because they got, obviously payment just got made, and guy's going back to his truck, and I see like Rock Bands and other stuff stacked already in the front seat of his car. I was like, man, I missed it by about 10 minutes. Because yeah. I got there 15 minutes after the yard sales were supposed to have started. So I'm like, oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you call him? He's a game hunter.
He's a reseller. I can tell you right now that he's a reseller looking forward. I tried about the seven or eight other ones that were available in my area, and nothing went up dry. But yeah, all that was left was sports games and stuff that really wasn't going to turn any type of profit for me. So I was like, I missed it. So the goal, if you want to get into this reselling thing, early bird catches the worm.
Early bird catches the worm. I know. It's all about being in the right place at the right time and never make a deal just because. You always hold out. You're always going to have one person that will pay the full price of something, as I have learned multiple times.
But, unless it is for sports games.
Unless for sports games or a Baron Harkonnen action figure.
There you go, indeed. But it is, of course, Josh the Great Peterson, along with me, Gerald Glassford. Thanks so much for watching and listening. Truly appreciate it. It is Dune Part 2. Josh has finally seen it when Melinda Barkhouse Ross, who, by the way, said she wants to get, and Jamie Monroy concurred, that we would all agree, if all of us on the show would agree to go ahead and get a Pop Culture Cosmos guy tattoo, like the one I have of the Avengers there, she said that she would be game to do it. Jamie said he would be game to do it. I said, if we all did that, including Josh and TJ Johnson, I'll think about it. I think we may do it. I won't do a Mark Ruffalo, and we'll leave it at that.
I'd want mine in a teardrop, though, coming down.
No, just has to be a small little something discreet, wherever you want to put it. I just, again, all if right, you're a game and everybody else was game, I'll do it.
All right. Well, I'm game. So just let me know when, okay. when will the deed be done, and we'll make it happen.
I'll have to see. Just one more person to ask. I'm not sure he'll go for it. We'll see. I don't know if he has tats or whatnot, but I'll have to see if he'll do it. But yeah, we'll talk about it. Melinda has tats. Jamie has tats. I have this right here. So yeah, who knows? Just a little pop culture cosmos guy indeed. But it is, of course, the PCC, Pop Culture Cosmos. It is Dune Part 2, my friend. First off, what type of theater did you experience this on?
We had, it's called like D-Box or something like that. Cinemark has it. It's not an IMAX, but that's just what the...
Okay, because I did Cinemark XD is what they have out here.
See, we don't have, like, we have Cinemark, but we don't have an XD theater. It's called D-Box. Like, and that's, I don't know what that stands for, but that's like the big, you know, you walk in and you have like the theaters, and but then you have like one special theater with like the digital poster and all that. Mm-hmm. That's what we were in. And I don't know. Maybe I should actually look up what D-Box stands for.
Okay. Well, just the reason why I ask is I wanted to hear as far as your initial experience of what you viewed this film, which is so audio and visually enhanced for a film audience, especially shot on IMAX, and as far as certain scenes specifically take hold of you in an audio format, almost like a haptic reaction in your seat, as far as what I experienced in XD. But I've already been a little bit descriptive in a non-spoilerish form. I'm going to let everybody know that from now on, our comments in regards to the reviews for Dune Part 2 now and in the future will go into spoilers. So spoiler alert for Dune Part 2. But Josh, I'm going to give you the floor, my friend. Your experience today, fresh off of seeing Dune Part 2.
Okay. So I liked it. I thought it was good. Me and actually went with my kids to see it, and I was thinking to myself, oh, they're gonna get, because we watched the first one earlier this week together, and they seemed to enjoy it. So I think that was a good thing, because I found myself at certain parts getting bored, like listening to all the political stuff that was going on, but they were still very intrigued by what was happening on the screen. Which is good, you know, because they did a good job of blending spectacle with the political, what do you call it, political religious pieces of it. So it wasn't too focused on one thing or another. So they had like the sandworms were cool, but then within like the sandworms, then you get a little bit of, I don't know, the political dialogue and all that. So I don't know. They blended all that very well. And I remember from reading the book that the pacing on that stuff was, you know, not amazing, but, yeah. Okay. So I know you gave it a 10 out of 10. I think I'm more at like an 8.5, 9 maybe for me. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the perfect movie. There's something about the world of Dune. When you go to it, it doesn't make you feel good. And I know that's not the point of it, but it's a very uncomfortable place to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can't say I blame you. That's not any trouble at all. I mean, because remember, it is believed at the time that it was created that it was supposed to be this unfilmable adaptation, that nobody would really be able to do it justice in any shape or form.
Yeah. Yeah, and it... Denis Villeneuve did a great job of bringing it to life. You know, I loved seeing Stilgar is probably one of my favorite characters in that movie. Like, they did a great job with him. You know, especially his, what do you call it? Like, his beliefs in both the religious part. What is it? The what do they call it? The don't know, whatever religion they practice, the Mahadib or whatever, like his belief in
Moadib.
Yeah. The Messiah version of Paul versus Paul himself. Like, I think that there's a very interesting, I don't know, what do you call it there? Like a,
the
like
destiny, whatever it's been, as far as been, you know, scriptures, as far as everything that's what, you know, supposedly is meant to happen is, you know, it's,
right. Was,
you know, written about, talked about, prophesized about, the prophecy, yeah, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, so they did a good job of like showing Stilgar's like belief in that and his belief in Paul. Like, they're two different things, and like you could tell when Paul was writing the worm, he had like a proud papa moment, right? Like, he's really proud of like this kid and what he'd done, and I don't know. So I thought that was neat, the relationship aspect between Paul and Chani. Yeah, was I don't know, I think it was well done. I would have liked to see actually, I don't know, I think they did a great job with it. And so my one major critique of the film was that I actually, two things. One, did not like the black and white
for the Harkonnen's home planet.
For the Harkonnen's home planet, like, I get what they were trying to do, but I looking at it, like, that shot could have been absolutely beautiful had they shown the grains, the brown grainish color of the sand. Like, that could have been an amazingly filmed shot, but instead they chose to keep it in black and white.
Well, that's because their sun, they lose the light because the damage to their sun.
Right. I don't know. I just
represent that with darkness.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's just kind of like, it wasn't, it pulled me out of the spectacle a little bit, because I'm sitting there thinking, like, why did they choose to go with this instead of something else, you know? But anyways, I would have really loved to see more of the battle. Like, I feel like they really shied away from that. That in the end of the movie, you know, when the Emperor's troops land and you get to see the armies going at it with each other, it just kind of shows the Fremen as this this force that just overruns everything. I would have loved to see more combat between the two sides. I feel like that was kind of a missed opportunity.
Okay, and that was near the end of Dune Part Two, as far as the actual climactic battle. Is that correct, between the Sardaukar, yes, Harkonnen, because,
right, Emperor's
forces, etc.?
Yeah, exactly. And they spent the entire movie building up towards that. They kept talking about it's going to be a war, a battle's going to happen, and they didn't actually like show a lot of it. You know, I did enjoy watching Paul fight Austin Butler's character, which actually Austin Butler's character was, you know, he did a really great job playing that, because I was looking at him and I was terrified the whole time. So they did a good job bringing that character to life. But yeah, like, I would have loved to see more of the fight. And, you know, that's just me, but I would have loved to see more of like those shots of the two sides coming together and fighting. I don't know. They could have focused on it just a little bit more, and I think that would have really made a huge difference for me.
What if in Doom Messiah, which the opening scenes kind of lead you into, possibly because the ending is where the other houses refuse to acknowledge Paul Atreides as the new emperor, because he, you know, overtakes the emperor. He defeats Austin Butler's character, Foyd, and he is now the de facto emperor. But as he wants to claim the throne, the other houses, which were called upon by the Harkonnens, saying they were in need of aid, now they refuse to acknowledge Paul Atreides as that. You could be seeing, to open up Dune Messiah, a kind of like a galactic war on that scope, and seeing how different that might be from what you're used to seeing as far as space battles are concerned, especially because the fact that it's all supposed to be propelled by spice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that could be interesting, could be a very cool way to open that film. But also, I'm curious, because I know Dune Messiah opens up 30 years after the ending of Dune. So I'm really curious, like, if they're going to make that age jump with Paul or not, because that could kind of dictate like how well those following scenes play out.
I have a feeling they won't. I have a feeling they'll devote at least some time to what Paul is going to do as far as the battles are concerned. That's just my guess, because it just seems to set up for something very monumental on a space battle realm that, you know, maybe the likes of Dune would have never, even Frank Herbert creating Dune might not have ever possibly imagined, because that, it just seems like it's setting itself up for that. But getting to the actual structure of the movie, I understand that the political backstabbing, political intrigue, and religious themes as far as the fundamentalists versus the non-believers, that battle, did not sway you as much, because it is a great part of the Dune, which I think is probably one of the underlying reasons many people thought that this adaptation, this book was unfilmable, this story was unfilmable, because it relies so heavily on religion and also as well politics in order to propel the story. And like you said, even when it paused to go ahead and devote some time to it, it didn't seem to grab you on that part.
No, so I'm not to say it didn't grab me, but there were parts when I found myself getting bored. And it's weird, because like there's so much of that in the real world, you know. It's almost, it's hits too close to home, like it's too relatable. They always, science fiction authors are, they're like prophets in a way, you know, because ever since they started writing these books in the 80s, it's like they've been predicting how the world is going to end up. And so I'm sitting there watching this, I'm like, oh man, I feel like I'm watching a like a 24-hour news cycle. They're just showing all the stuff that's happening in the world right now. So I don't know, like I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it was good. I didn't dislike it. It just like felt, it didn't feel fresh to me, just because we get so much of that in TV already, if that makes sense.
For the latest news and information, analysis and opinions on the Los Angeles Lakers and the NBA, check out the Lakers Fast Break podcast today on wherever you get your podcasts. Once again, it is Josh the Great Peterson from happyhoardercollectibles.com. It is, of course, me, Gerald Glassford, as well. Thanks so much again for watching this. It is our Dune Part 2 spoiler cast. So, Josh, what parts did you really enjoy? You said you give it an 8.5, a 9 out of 10, which is still an outstanding score. I said some of the most compelling scenes, some of the best scenes I have seen in quite some time, in decades, perhaps. It just, the kind of scenes that moved me like very few others have. And I gave the reference as far as the scene, opening scene in, just some of the great scenes that we've seen over the course of time in regards to movies are concerned. It just seemed like there were some very compelling scenes, like the sandworm scenes.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts as regards to that or some other scenes that really compelled you?
Yeah, the sandworm scenes were really cool. You know, you kind of sit there watching Paul try to summon this worm, and he ends up summoning one of the grandfather worms. And so it kind of made that whole scene feel a lot more intense, because you're like, oh man, look at how big that thing is. And they did a great job with that. Like it's the, you know, the sandworms don't look, they look like they belong there. You know, that's not like some cheap CG cinematic, and you know, with Paul writing on it, actually looks really great. So I think that scene was definitely one of the best scenes in the movie. I also really enjoyed the scenes with within, what do you call it, the place where they are, where the Fremen live. Like I really enjoyed like seeing all that, like seeing how the Fremen coexisted with each other, and seeing how they
underground or in the ground. Yeah.
And then they jumped into, you know, Paul taking down the spice harvesters and causing a little bit of hell for the Harkonnens. Like I think all of that played out really well. Like, I think that those were probably some of the most exciting moments in the movie. I did really, you know, you said that somebody comes back, like Gunny, seeing Gunny again, like that was really cool.
Gurney.
Too. Gurney, yeah. But yeah, seeing him again, that was really neat. And you can kind of see the hostility between Chani and Gurney, and how they, you know, didn't really see eye to eye on anything. And then the vault with all the atomics, like, I don't know, you kind of like it, all of that made the scale of the movie feel so much bigger. And I really appreciated that.
As I said, some of the scenes were absolutely monumental to me as far as filmmaking is concerned. I mean, the sandworms, absolutely. The scene initially where he gets on and rides it for the first time is absolutely thrilling. I was going to mention Saving Private Ryan, the opening scene from that movie, where it is just absolutely floors you at how dynamic that shot, those minutes were, as far as when they hit Omaha Beach in Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
In this movie, when he gets on the sandworm for the first time, if you're in the right context, right theater with the right sound system, you feel like you're part of it. You feel like you're there riding the sandworm yourself. Your thoughts as you were watching this portrayed on screen.
Yeah, it definitely, you did feel immersed. They did a good job with the audio, you know, and the, as far as like in the soundtrack going at the same time. All the sound mixing was really great for this movie. They did a really good job. And you know, seeing him, you see him like throw his hooks onto the worm and the little flaps come up, you know, like that was really cool. Cause they didn't really go into detail about like how, there wasn't a scene where he's teaching him how to ride. He's just kind of getting out there and doing it. So that was, it was unexpected, but it's also, what would you call it? Like a visual feast. But this is my problem though. Like the buildup to that big battle, everything was so amazing and so well done. And then it just kind of, they don't show much with the battle scene. And that was why I think it was so disappointing, because
it transitioned quickly inside the actual, the Emperor's ship itself.
Right. We went like uphill the whole time. And then all of a sudden it just goes flat. You know, like I want to see what's like the little kid in The Incredibles. What are you waiting for? Something amazing. You know, that's what I was waiting for.
And all you hear is like the commotion going on outside. I get it. As Paul nears where the Emperor was located at. So I can get that. You're not the first to say that they've had issues with it. I was okay with it, because I think that for me, I know that something else is coming. I know that there's a larger battle in scope that I believe is going to take place in Doom Messiah. So maybe that's why I was okay with it. Plus, I had seen already smaller battles throughout the entirety of Dune Part 2. I think I was also anticipating that knife fight, which we saw with, you know, Fade and of course, Paul Atreides. We always know who wins that battle, which is Paul Atreides. But I think that's probably why. And I wanted to see how they were going to go ahead and manipulate that scene differently from the books. And obviously, the way they disposed of Baron Harkonnen was a little bit different. Still met the ultimate ending as far as it's concerned. And so same thing with, you know, all the Harkonnens, how they met their ending. It's a little, they differed a little bit in each case from the book, but still ultimately all met their demise. And I think overall the way that was mapped out for me was much better than what I thought it was going to end up being, because, you know, you see Dune 1984 and you just have this like bad, I have a view of the way that Dune wraps itself up as far as the original book is concerned. And that concept for me is totally changed by the way I saw it. And I perceived it in Dune Part 2.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly like a page-for-page adaptation. It's kind of, I guess, in its own right, it's a retelling of Dune. I mean, while sticking close to the source material, but yeah, they're doing a great job with it. I mean, you'd watch it, like you said, the old version of it it feels unwatchable at you know today. But yeah, I don't know. I'm curious to see like where they're gonna go, you know, like we talked last time though, a lot of the stuff with Dune is like really weird, so it's just like what are they going to change to kind of bring this to a conclusion for modern audiences.
One thing I want to ask you before we hit the break, and that is your overall opinion as compared to Dune Part One. I think I'm going to see it one more time before I make the determination whether or not it is better, or for lack of a better term, not quite as good as Dune Part Two. I don't know, because I'm on the fence. I absolutely loved Dune Part One. I know people talked about the pacing and some of the, you know, talking points in it. I absolutely got invested and involved in that world building. I thought the acting was compelling there. I thought Timothée Chalamet's performance here was outstanding as he grew into his realization that he had to undergo this transformation into the Messiah that he was made out to be, that the prophecy was making him out to be. Shani, as far as Zendaya's performance, was really, really good as far as her character being, I guess broadened and expanded upon than what even the books have dictated. I think the performances are really compelling, and I think there is no slouch. I know Dave Bautista, who is a great favorite of ours, normally does an outstanding job, actually did a good job here, but people are saying, oh, well, all he does is yell and scream in this movie. That's all his character does. Hello, that's what he does. So he did it great. He did it beautifully. So even him, to my great admiration, they all did a great job. Even Christopher Walken decided not to do a normal Christopher Walken type deal and actually played it straight. Your thoughts on the acting before we head to the break, my friend?
Yeah, the acting was great, especially, I know we talked to us before, but Austin Butler's character did a great job of being absolutely terrifying. And I think that was Skarsgård playing Baron Harkonnen. I think he did a great job too, because that character is just, there's no sanity in that character, and so like you keep looking at him and you're like, oh man, this guy's psychotic, but what's he gonna do next? So you are compelled, your eyes are glued to the screen. Timothy Chalamet's character, I feel like there's a point in Dune 2 where the character development kind of stopped and he just kind of went, you know, he just kind of cruised the rest of the movie. But, you know, with Dune Part 1 and you know, the parts up to the middle of Dune Part 2, they did a good job of putting him together. I'm trying to think, like, who was I especially compelled by? And I would have to say Stilgar is my favorite. You know, I think he was probably the best character, the most well acted character in that movie.
Again, to me, there was no slouches at all in regards to this. I think, like you said, Javier Bardem as Stilgar did an outstanding job. Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica, as the Bene Gesserit herself, as she becomes and transforms into something much more powerful from Dune Part One. But Dune Part One, Dune Part Two, again, you can't go wrong with either of my books, but sounds like you lean Dune Part One a little tiny bit more than Dune Part Two.
Yeah, so I thought Dune Part One was beautifully shot. I thought the acting was great. I loved Oscar Isaac, his character in that movie. The world building was incredibly fascinating. And to me, it was just because it was mysterious, right? Like, we didn't really know anything about it, about what was going to happen. And especially like Paul's vision, they showed little brief glimpses. So you kept wondering like what was going to be next. And I think that had kind of an enchanting hold over me. I do wish that I saw it in theater so I could see like how the sound was meant to come out. But yeah, right now I think Dune Part One's probably more of a favorite for me, but I do need to see Dune Part Two again at some point.
But absolutely an outstanding film for me, and Josh liked it as well. But we want to hear your thoughts on Dune Part Two. Please let us know. PopCultureCosmos@yahoo.com.
What is Planet Cool Stuff? It's your ultimate destination for insightful exploration from the realm of pop culture. Delve into the world of movies, video games, toys, cartoons, and visit with one-of-a-kind creators, discover incredible places, and see historical artifacts. Whether it's a toy room tour or exploring the best of pop culture cinema, Planet Cool Stuff has got you covered. Planet Cool Stuff, exclusively on Jinx Esports TV Canada.
It is Gerald Glassford. Thanks so much for watching and listening. Truly appreciate it. Along with Josh Peterson, thanks so much again for going ahead and being a part of what we're doing here at the Pop Culture Cosmos. Cool bro, it is Aaliyah, as far as Paul's sister's name in the movie, just to let you know. But again, you have to go ahead and check out what part and what role she plays in the movie for that one, because it is a bigger spoiler than all of those big spoils. And I'll probably go ahead into more detail with that when Melinda Barkhouse-Ross catches the film, and we'll go into even more spoilers on Dune Part 2 in the coming days and weeks right here at the Cosmos. Yes, there is going to be a Part 3, Cool Bro. It is Dune Messiah. It is currently being written up by Denis Villeneuve now. Before we get into our facing the franchise with something Denis Villeneuve has a hand in, your thoughts on, of course, it does, the movie does set up for a sequel again. And I know some people criticize Dune Part 1's ending for setting up Dune Part 2. Dune Part 2 is setting itself up for a Dune Part 3. Your thoughts on it setting itself up for a Dune Part 3, which would be based off the book Dune Messiah?
Well, it's kind of the nature of the beast, right? Especially with a series like Dune, it doesn't have any clean stopping points. And that's another sign of science fiction from the 60s, 70s, 80s. They all did that. I mean, look at Edgar Rice Burroughs' Princess of Mars books, and then you have Ender's Game. Dune is it. None of them have clear starting points. Clear stopping points. So it, how far do they want to go, I guess, is the big question here. But yeah, I mean, they've already set up the next thing with Paul. I think that it's the third or fourth book where Paul's story kind of winds down a little bit. So maybe they'll do four. What will Denis Villeneuve do all of them? Who's to say? But it's more of a,
he's committed to three. That's the only thing we know for sure.
Because it's more of a chronology, I think is the word I'm looking for. It's not really like a, they're not meant to have like clear cut, oh, and then everything was fine after this.
Well, I tell you what, my friend, I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping you are as well. It is Dune Messiah, Dune Part 3. Looking forward to seeing if we can go ahead and checking that out. We'll go ahead and talk about here in the coming days and weeks as far as the success for Dune Part 2 right here at the Pop Culture Cosmos. It is, of course, Josh the Peterson and Gerald Glassford. Thanks so much for watching and listening. Truly appreciate it. We are facing the franchise with something Denis Villeneuve does know well, because he said, as I mentioned to you, if you read the article in recent times, I believe it was Hollywood Reporter, that he still has nightmares about his time adapting the world of Blade Runner in Blade Runner 2049, which he should not be ashamed of, because it is a beautiful and outstanding film. It sounds like it's still your number one Denis Villeneuve film, my friend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I read that article. It's funny because when you said that to me initially, I was like, that's weird, because he did an amazing job. He was afraid that he wouldn't be able to fill the shoes of Ridley Scott. And I don't know. I think he did it. Okay, this is going to make me sound unpopular, but I think that he did it better than Ridley Scott did. Ridley Scott, he was a master of filmmaking for his time, but you know, you have this young blood come and breathe new life into his universe. And I think he did an amazing job with it. It's just like in Alien, right? When everyone's like, I wish Ridley Scott would direct another Alien film. And then we got, Alien, what was the last one? Alien something or other. That was a sequel to Prometheus. And it was just kind of a.
And then they're going to do the television series is what they've got next. Is that correct? Or is it a new movie?
There's both. There's a movie and there's a television series coming out. So I don't. Oh, sorry. For Blade Runner or Alien, what are we talking about?
Alien.
Yeah. There's Alien. Noah something or other. I forget what the director's name.
We're going to face the franchise someday with Alien, because that's something I know that you particularly like, is that series. But yeah, you also like the Blade Runner series. That's something that we first, one of the first things we really bonded on was our love, combined love for Blade Runner, my friend. The original Blade Runner that was developed by Ridley Scott, one of his best outings ever as a director, in my opinion, as a film way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. It is, I believe, number one on my all-time list. If you go ahead and take a look at popculturecosmos.wordpress.com. So you know I love it. I know you love it, my friend. But tell us, what compelled you about Blade Runner?
So Blade Runner is it's a very interesting film because you have to watch it multiple times. So there's like three different cuts of it, and you have to watch, it's not the director's cut. You have to watch the final cut to really get the full experience of what Blade Runner is. And you have to watch it multiple times because it's one of those films you don't understand during the first watch through. And then you watch it, you know, two or three more times, and finally the pieces start to make sense, you know, like the whole concept of the replicants, and, you know, are they people or are they not people? Why do people hate them? What sets them apart? Why were they created? You know, and are they going to replace humanity? They pose all these questions to you. And it's especially prevalent today in the fact that we have, you know, with AI doing what it is now, and all these lifelike robots being created by all these different companies. You sit there and wonder, is Blade Runner coming true? You know, much like Frank Herbert and Edgar Rice Burroughs and all these people, these science fiction writers predicting the future, here we are. So, you know, it's always been fascinating to me because is that going to be our future? Granted, Blade Runner, was it 2024? You know, the world is supposed to look like that now and it doesn't. So they're slightly off there. But I don't know. I still think that Blade Runner is an amazing Blade Runner 2020 was. I'm sorry, I'm having a brain fart. Is Blade Runner 2049. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. But yeah, I don't know. Like, it's such an intriguing world because it's also slightly terrifying, right? To see like where humanity has ended up. And I don't know about you, but I think seeing Blade Runner 2049 was kind of made the first movie that much better. You know, I've never seen a sequel that did that for its predecessor, because you watch Blade Runner 2049 and you're like, oh, this kind of puts the first movie into perspective by really explaining more about why this world exists and how this was able to happen. And I was really hoping that the film franchise would go more places, but I guess we're getting an Amazon Prime show. But I don't know, it seemed like it was ready to be bigger than it ended up being.
I will ask you this though, how much has it affected you? Because you have watched it, I'm sure, several times like I have over the years. I've watched as many cuts of the original film, because the original film has like 7 or 8 different cuts. So I've been privileged, I would say, to see most of the cuts that have been made available to the public for it in some public form or another. Not all of them, but I have seen most of them. And I'm just absolutely floored every time as far as the vision from that era. But with you, a lot of the visuals come into play as far as color palettes, as far as scope, as far as the special effects at that point in time, really well done, that still hold up today.
Oh, absolutely. And you see all the different pop culture properties that look and feel has inspired. Like, look, we got Total Recall, Akira. It even like branched into anime. Like, Akira was another one that had similar look and feel to Blade Runner. I don't know, there's been a lot of films that have taken that, been inspired by that, and because of that, I think that it's really left its mark. I mean, I can't say for sure. Like, I wish I had the chance to see it like right when it first came out, but so that I could, you know, truly compare it to something. But I don't know. I mean, of all the movies that I've seen, you know, I've spent a lot of time when I was a teenager watching old films, and, you know, seeing Blade Runner and seeing the way that it came to life, and the signs in the sky and all this, like watching what the world looks like, it to me, I think it still holds up pretty well.
And again, they've gone into other directions, animes, even a full-fledged anime series, but they had shorts that were made around the time of Blade Runner 2049. But it is Blade Runner 2049 that came out here decades later. It came out actually, was it 2017, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, we were on it right away. We absolutely love this film. I mean, you know, depending on who you talk to and depending on who you look at with this film, they consider it one of the best films of the last decade. I, and I'm pretty sure you as well, have considered it among the very best movies of the previous decade. It is absolutely a monumental feat. And Denis Villeneuve, see, again, he made the comments that he is director of Dune Part 2, by the way, just to let everybody know. He commented that he still stays up at nights in regards to how he felt and what some of the things that he did in this adaptation with Ridley Scott there as an executive producer. So it's not like Ridley Scott was totally shut out. And Ridley Scott in recent times has kind of bad-mouthed a little bit, which I think is unwarranted. He said he would have never allowed this to happen again. He would have done it himself, blah, 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 blah. Well, again, even if he did it himself as far as a sequel to it, I don't think he would have been able to do better than Blade Runner 2049. I'm standing on that hill at how magnificent a sequel and a follow-up after so many decades that have passed since the original film that this movie is. It is just absolutely fantastic. The cinematography on that film is fantastic. You always talk about the colors. I think that movie absolutely blends colors so well. And it's Harrison Ford's best acting job of this millennia. And it's not even close because he is, I love him as an actor. Always creates a fun time for me, but he is just gone in for the cash in a lot of these roles later in life and just been there and just done Harrison Ford throughout. This one, he actually showed and showcased his acting range and showcased his emotion in this film. Jared Leto is absolutely mesmerizing as the pseudo bad guy type deal as far as that's concerned. And I mean, there's just an absolute great cast. It is definitely something you need to get into. It is, I know people have issues with the pace at times when they talk about this film, but Ana de Armas was fantastic. Robin Wright was really good in it. It just absolutely, Sylvia Hoeks as Love, she was fantastic as and absolutely scary as the real bad person in this film, as far as the individual that was facing off against Ryan Gosling's Kay. This film is absolutely underrated and really, I think, makes the Blade Runner IP really, really transformed into what it is and what it shall be, hopefully, going forward.
Yeah, you know what's funny? I think if the original Blade Runner had come out, you know, within the past 10 years, I think that Blade Runner 2040, or, you know, the past 10, 15 years, Blade Runner 2049 would have absolutely smashed it in the box office. And, you know, we talk about Ridley Scott, how he's, you know, not crazy fond of it. I don't think that modern Ridley Scott is much of a filmmaker anymore. I think that his heyday has come and gone. I still love his movies, but I would not trust him to take something that he created and make it better, you know, as we've seen with the modern Alien flicks.
I will tell you though, it's going to be very interesting to see how this series wraps up. If it's done well, as far as through the proposed Amazon, the Amazon series that's going to be hopefully coming up in the coming years, if it's done well, if it's done to the level that you and I both hope it is, we'll see. I hope they give it the love it absolutely deserves. But it is the Blade Runner franchise. It is something that both Josh and I have a great affinity for. Where does Blade Runner 2049 rank among your all-time favorite movies? Because I put my... See, that's the thing. You have not done a My Top 25. I've got a My Top 25 on popculturecosmos.wordpress.com, which I have updated, but not yet with Doom Part 2. I don't know if I've put it in there yet. Maybe I will. We'll see.
I know. I you know, that's always hard for me to people ask, like, what's your, my kids ask that all the time, like, what's your favorite movie? And it's hard for me to, like,
I think we need to sit down one of these days.
I know, but it changes so much, though. Like, my number one, you know, like it depends on what I'm feeling.
Well, that's why WordPress has this thing called an editor.
Oh my gosh, man. If it's a rainy day, like, my go-to is always Garden State, but I will literally watch Kingdom of Heaven any day of the week. You know, that's tough. All right. I'm going to have to think on this and get back to you.
Okay. Because I put it out there for people to see, my top 25 of popculturecosmos.wordpress.com. Yep. So you need to go ahead and do the same one of these days before we get the tattoos. I'll go that. But we'll see.
All right.
But it is Facing the Franchise with Blade Runner. Please let us know your thoughts on where Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049 rank in your all-time list. If you actually appreciate it for what it is, or if you have opinions on it, against it. Because we've, in the years that we've been doing this show, Josh and I have heard from people that aren't the fondest fans of Dune, of course, but also Blade Runner. So please let us know your thoughts on Blade Runner, the IP, and the franchise, as we face the franchise with Blade Runner, popculturecosmos@yahoo.com. If you're in the Las Vegas and Henderson areas and are looking to buy, sell, or trade the best in classic or current video games and pop culture collectibles, there's no better place to go than Retro City Games. From Xbox to PlayStation, Nintendo to Atari, the great crew at Retro City Games provides the best place to go for all your gaming options. Stop by their two awesome locations in Henderson and also the Las Vegas Strip, or follow Retro City Games on Facebook and Instagram for all the latest deals and new items. Without a doubt, there's no better place to go for your gaming needs than your friends at Retro City Games. Well, my friend, I wanted to talk about this last part of the show, something a little bit different, because as you know, and as you found out, and I found out, our friends, great supporters of the show, Retro City Games, as you heard on this commercial just before the break, because I played the audio commercial for our audio listeners out there, saying about the two locations that they have in Henderson and on the Las Vegas Strip for now. They are one of the premium retro resellers in town. You go to their Henderson location, and they are filled with nothing but retro gaming and retro toys. It is absolutely just amazing the amount of stuff they want. I stopped by there this week to talk to Douglas Hoyabu, our good friend with Retro City Games, the guy who owns both locations. He found out this week, the hard way, that his store is no longer needed at the Town Square location on Las Vegas Boulevard. It's not because of any mispayments, not because of anything that he has done wrong on this end. It's just that they don't want a store like his. And there's like four or five others, I believe, that are in my research that are having the same fate. All these stores are, for some one reason or another, just not quite what they want anymore at Town Square, I guess. But this is something we were trying to go back and forth as to really why. And I've tried to tell him over the years that I think there's a stigma when it comes to what we do in pop culture. It's not just a video game store. I'll give you an example. CES, I've been going as a member of the press for well over a decade, but for this previous one, I was refused because they looked at my site and they said, oh, it's a pop culture. I heard them on the phone. It's a pop culture. It's a pop culture site. It's a pop culture site. Sorry, we're not going to grant you press. So I had to go in and just to keep my record going and obviously say what I needed to see at the Consumer Electronics Show as a general member, which I'm still blessed and I'm still very appreciative of. But, you know, it's kind of disappointing that I cannot cover it like I normally have in the previous years that I was allowed to and graciously allowed access to. I just think the stigma, like, for instance, what you do with Happy Hoarder Collectibles and what you deal with and what is all the stuff you got behind you, all the stuff I got behind me, the world of pop culture, there's a stigma attached. I told Doug, I said, I equate it a lot to professional wrestling. Professional wrestling sometimes is a necessary evil for the television marketplaces to eat up hours, to eat up time, and it has a designated audience that will watch it in and out week after week. There's an Aussie audience. There's a designated audience for pop culture that will always be there week after week after week. But because they look like me, guys or gals that come out with Star Wars shirts or whatever, that may not always fit what they choose. They, meaning individuals that just don't get things in pop culture, that just don't get it for whatever reason. Your thoughts on this, my friend, because I think there is a stigma to pop culture fanaticism in some form or another, pop culture industry as a whole, that people, they just want the money from, but it's just a stigma that they don't want everything else associated with it. There are certain individuals out there that just, they kind of look down and thumb their nose to us in the world of pop culture. Your thoughts on this, my friend?
Yeah, it's interesting because we do, there are so many different pop culture properties out there, and a lot of like the things that come out, like why would somebody want to buy a statue of an anime character, or why would somebody want to buy a replica sword of that was held by Aragorn during Lord of the Rings? Like there's a lot of stuff that people spend their money on in the realm of pop culture that other people just don't understand.
For instance, let's talk for just a second about Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball. Right. I mean, a lot of people are devastated and stunned and very saddened by his loss, because he passed away at the age of 68 in the past couple of days. And other people just don't get it. Other people just don't get it. Why there's so many people mourning his loss as far as how great a pioneer he was in the manga, in the world of pop culture as a whole.
You know what's insane to me about that is that you have in school, right? You have to, because as an English teacher, I'm guilty of this. Like you have to pound the classics into the heads of the kids, right? Whether it's Frankenstein or 1948 or 1984, I meant to say, or whatever it is, Diary of Anne Frank, Knight, whatever it is that you have set on your curriculum. You sit there every year and you pound into the heads of these kids. But Akira Toriyama, like, he wrote things that kids actually wanted to go read. And parents sit there like, oh, what is this trash? But they don't understand it because they've never placed themselves in that universe. And Akira Toriyama has done a great job of using his writing and his art, his illustrations to reach in generations and generations of kids. Like it's not just, he's been around since the late 70s, early 80s, and even today kids are still seeking, hungrily seeking more things that he's made. And you look at it, it's the same thing with pop culture. Like pop culture has bridged the gap between generations in a way that cars and money and houses and music videos, like in ways that none of that stuff could ever do. And that's kind of that, I guess that's the problem, right? It's like it's its own little world, and people don't take the time to understand it, because, and if they did, like, it creates this human connection that we take for granted, you know. And that's I guess what's so heartbreaking about all this.
So let's say you, because you do right now, you go to malls, you go to strip malls, you go to conventions, temporary places. So these malls, these conventions, everybody seems to be happy to take your money at this point in time for your spots. Yeah. But let's say you want to go and build a Happy Hoarder Collectibles permanent location or locations where you're at in Texas. You know, are you expecting everybody to open, you know, give you, like, if you have the money to go ahead and pay whatever it is they need, they're asking for, do you expect everybody to come in with open arms as you are looking for a place to go ahead and open up, let's say, your said business on that? Because again, getting back to Douglas at Retrocity Games, it's not an issue of whether or not they could afford it. You can see the amount of success that they're doing. You can see that the amount of followers that they have, you can see how well that they have grown by leaps and bounds to become the premier destination for retro gaming in Southern Nevada. Yet they are treated like this because maybe they don't fit exactly what certain places or certain individuals want for their atmosphere.
Out here,
that's my opinion, but I'm just surmising. That's why.
Yeah, no, I agree. Out here, that happens too. Like, there's we have a mall where I set up a lot of the time. Like, there's an anime store in there called Anime Marketplace, and the mall showed up to them one day, and they're like, "Hey, we're cutting your lease," and they're like, "You can either take this one available space here, or you can pack your bags."
Let me guess, the space was in a lower, much lower traffic area.
The space was in a much lower traffic area, but the space that he had, it turned out that it was, what do you call it? Foot Locker, I think, was a company that bought it. They came in and they're like, we want this space and we're willing to pay this much money for it. And you know, we'll renovate and everything. So the mall was like, "Oh, hey, I can charge more money for this company to occupy this space than the current Anime Marketplace guy, who much like Doug was making his rent from day to day. So not day to day, sorry, from month to month without any issues. So lo and behold, when a more lucrative opportunity, I don't so much think that it's the people don't want these stores here. I think it's the people who run these retail spaces that when they see an opportunity to make more money or they see something that's preventing them from making more money. Yeah. They're not going to put something in, you know, they're probably odds are they're pushing Doug out because they want some sort of like designer storefront there.
Oh, and that's what I told him. I said, the answer, if you're asking that question or anybody else asking that question, why they're letting Retro City Games go in the Town Square location on Las Vegas Boulevard, give Town Square a thumbs down, by the way, if you see them. I'm not going to say I'm never going to go there again because I'm sure I'll have to go there for something. But I will say, though, the answer lies in what will ever appear next in that spot. So if something appears next of a little, I don't know, let's say a perfume store or just a famous clothing store or something like that, then I think that's your answer. I think that's your answer. But getting back to my question again, as we close this on out, my friend, do you think there's a stigma attached to pop culture?
Oh, absolutely. But it's funny because it's the people who have a ton of money from things that don't have to do with pop culture are the ones that don't understand it and won't take time. Like, oh, why do you want to invest time and energy in that when you could have, you could have cars cars and big houses and things like that. So there's a lack of understanding and a lack of desire to understand. And, you know, there is a stigma with pop culture. You know, pop culture people look like me and you. You know, why? No, never mind the stories that create these beautiful connections between people who enjoy this medium. Like, to people outside of this, like, they just don't understand and they never will.
And that's a shame because, again, as humans, we all like our outlets. We all like the things that we have great interest in. And pop culture is something that some of us really have a great interest in. And it's a wonderful place to be in. You go to these conventions, you go to these stores, you experience Retro City Games. You see the delight in people looking up their history of their lives, or people, younger audiences looking at games from the past, toys from the past, and remarking how people my age experience those things and wanting to experience it themselves. Just the fascination that we as a culture have for pop culture. It's just very, very sad to see that some are looking down upon it because it doesn't meet their quota or agenda. And hopefully that will change. But I wish Retro City Games continued success. They will find bigger and better places to be. And of course, we will let you know where that is. We will keep running those great ads for Retro City Games, and we will continue being behind Doug, Nicole, Antonio, and everybody that does such an outstanding job at Retro City Games, my friend. My friend, it's been a great episode, but any last thoughts on what we talked about, or happy hoarders before we head on out?
We're doing a convention at the Cameron Park Zoo out here in Waco the weekend of the eclipse. So if you're in town, I know there's going to be a ton of people in town that weekend. So if you're in town, come by the booth at the Cameron Park Zoo and buy some collectibles.
So for Josh Peterson, it's Gerald Glassford. Thanks so much again for watching and listening. It is truly appreciated. It's another beautiful day in paradise right here in the pop culture cosmos. We thank you for listening. And here's hoping you have yourself a great one.